We'll get right into the first feature. Corey, welcome to the Green Majority.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So why don't we get right into exactly what the shuttle challenge is. Now, I baited people there with a little bit about why they're getting free gas, but let's leave them wondering about where the free gas comes from for now. Let's start at the beginning. This is a campaign to encourage drivers to improve their driving practices. Is that roughly it?
That's right. It's a campaign to try and encourage people to drive better and drive less. And we know, Darren, that 27% of all greenhouse gas emissions are related to our transportation sector. And we also know that up to 50% of our own personal emissions are due to our driving habits. And when we started kind of thinking about what would be the next kind of transportation program to engage the public on, we looked at, you know, compared it to where you have a meter. And we know that Toronto Hydro sends you a bill and you've got a meter tracking your usage. We know that Enbridge sends you a bill and tracking your natural gas usage. And you get a water bill from the City of Toronto, but there's no meter for driving to track your impact and track your habits. And so we said, well, what if we could put a meter in someone's car and had them drive around for a couple weeks to get a baseline and how they're doing and what their commute, the impact of their commute really is, and then give them the tips and tools to change and to improve their impact. And then that's followed up by a challenge period where you try and beat your baseline, and that's where the free gas comes in.
Sure. So, I mean, one of the ideas there that strikes me, I was thinking about, I'm in a car, if you include taxis, maybe 20 times a year. If you exclude taxis, maybe twice a year. I'm even in a vehicle, much less driving one. I don't even have a driver's license. But every once in a while, I'm in a situation where I'm forced to think about driving, and doing preparing for the interview is one of them. So one of the things that I've just sort of observed, because I, of course, mine, and I know Kevin's on board with this as well, are big transportation advocates, public transportation advocates. And just the idea of, like, you know, telling people, I said, you know, we should all, my position on public transit has always been everybody should be in favor of public transit. Everybody should be in favor of spending money on public transit, because if you're talking about, if you live in Mississauga and you need to drive to downtown Toronto or from whatever suburb to whatever downtown anywhere in the country, one of the biggest factors on how long that commute takes is how many other cars are on the road. Okay. So it's not about talking, you know, you, Corey, if you were saying, well, no, I like my car, I don't want to, okay, all right, well, you know, if you had a 40-minute drive, you can stay in your car, you can keep your car. But what if we get the three guys in front of you out of their cars?
Right.
Then now you have a faster drive to work, it's less stressful, less time-consuming, less gas, less costly. Everybody wins.
That's right. And our solution for this, and most of what Summerhill Impact does, is come up with pragmatic, practical solutions. We know that the average driver who lives in Mississauga can't just get rid of their car. In fact, we ran the Retire Ride campaign, which is that vehicle retirement program that ran for a couple years, and we retired over 138,000 cars. And when we did that, we noticed that up to 70% of the people who got rid of an old car went on to purchase a new one. And so that's why we came up with this campaign, because we were kind of like, well, if we're getting rid of old cars and we're getting a net environmental benefit because we're retiring all those old, you know, high polluting vehicles, we had to do something about how people use their cars. And you're right, if there's less cars on the road, then the people who do need to drive can do that. The other pragmatic thing that we came up with was the 10% piece. We know that we're not going to tell people, hey, get out of your cars and get into transit and everyone's going to do it. What we're asking people is to almost go on a diet. And it's a 10%, and everybody can do 10%, and you'll improve your life by it. So it's not like it's something that's bad that you kind of have to do, you know?
Mm-hmm. And so the angle I was sort of going at that with, which you picked up on very, very quickly there, was just the idea that any campaign about transit doesn't equate, you know, although Rob Ford might tell you differently, any transit or driving program or any of these environment and transit programs in general don't automatically, you know, isn't an anti-car campaign.
Right.
This is a let's reduce our cost campaign. This is a let's get other drivers, if you want to keep your car, let's get other drivers off the road. Let's reduce your costs. And have you had any trouble with traction on that sort of thing? Because there is such a stigma, maybe it's just in Toronto, but around any environmental / driving anything, people seem to have this knee jerk, you can't get me out of my car sort of reaction.
Right,
to
right. Well, what we're trying to do with this is we're trying to put ourselves into the actual drivers, into the driver's seat, you know, pardon the pun. But what we're trying to do is trying to get people and customize the message to the individual's usage. So by tracking the driver's habits through this meter, let's say somebody's driving in from Ajax, driving 200 kilometers every day to come into work. And we look at and we say, you know, it's unfeasible to tell them that they're going to, you know, go onto transit and do that. But by tracking that in the meter, we can actually customize a solution for them. We can tell them that there are people who you can carpool with in Ajax. We can tell them that there are ways to drive better by tuning up your cars and things like that. So we're not going to just blanket everyone and say, everyone, thou shalt take transit. We're going to customize the message based on the individual's behavior. And from that, you're actually going to get more behavior change because of that. So that's why we're doing it.
Now, we very recently had an interview with, and I apologize, I'm brain farting here for a minute. The guy's name is escaping me, but from Our Climate, Kevin, you'll remember a couple weeks ago where the guy that was putting the group putting the sort of cigarette-like warnings on the gas tanks.
Right.
That's a very, very different approach, but it seems to be going to the same sort of end. Do you think that the programs like that, one that's sort of encouraging and helpful and just sort of like, we want to encourage you to do whatever you can do whatever you want to do, but let me help you do it better, and a sort of nanny state type, you know, sort of that sort of angle. Are those sort of things in conflict? Can they work in concert? Is it one or the other? What
right.
do you think?
I think you're always going to need some regulatory backstop to encourage a massive modal shift in any kind of environmental campaign. But I also think the future of environmental campaigns is going to be around what you're alluding to, which is around these nudge campaigns. So nudging people in a certain direction based on their behavior so that they can actually make it easier for them to take that action. And this is the exact same thing that happens every single day to help to make us and force us to consume more products and services. So you've got companies out there that are using data and information that we're giving them freely through Facebook and Google all the time, and they're using that information to sell you more stuff. So what we said is, well, could we take all that data and actually drive more better social change and more behavior change? And so through a nudge campaign, by kind of encouraging people slightly to do that, then you're going to get there. But you also need that regulatory backstop. And you know, I know we're going to talk about Joe Oliver in a minute, but the federal government has come up with some very stringent guidelines on fuel efficiency, mimicking what they've done in California. So you need that in place to actually kind of create the base, and then you're going to need those nudge kind of campaigns to create the real behavior change.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what's actually been going on. I've got some notes here as well. You've got about 800 and just shy of 900 registrants to the program so far, 175 drivers working through four cohorts. Maybe you can you explain that system, or is this like a pairing system?
Yeah, so what it is every Monday we sign up, people have signed up. Every Monday a new cohort begins, and you drive for the 2 weeks, and then you do your eco driver training, and then you drive for the second 2 weeks. And so it's kind of a rolling cohort that allows us to kind of share the meters and to work out any bugs. So we've got we did a cohort in the fall. We had 45 drivers participate. We saw a 9% reduction in vehicle kilometers traveled and 8% reduction in gas consumed. And so far we've got 50 drivers who have completed the spring cohort, and they're tracking at a 16% reduction already. So it's a massive, massive shift you're seeing. And we're going beyond that kind of 10%. But the really important thing for me is, as I was alluding to earlier, is the data that we're receiving. So we now know where people are driving, when they're driving, how they're driving, and what kinds of interventions are working, and we can kind of customize the messages to those drivers, which would encourage them to kind of make that shift. And we know that then longer term, we can use that information to encourage them down the road to make sure they get oil changes and tune-ups and other kinds of things, and if they're going to buy a car, make sure that they buy the most fuel-efficient car.
So one of my sort of overarching criticisms that applies to everything environmental, and it's something I'm sort of aware of with my own message and with other people's message, is that, and you know, we just mentioned Rob Ford, so let's use him as an example. He had I'm not a fan of him personally. The show itself, of course, disclaimer, takes no position on politics, blah, 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 blah. I personally think he's a bit of a clown. But anyway, but the point was that the reason he was successful, or the reason a lot of people will tell you he was successful, was he had a simple message that everybody, you know, largely in general, maybe they didn't agree with the details, maybe they're not happy now that they've seen how he enacted that message, but the message was simple. People liked the message and they went for it. And that's a big problem, I think, with a lot of issues we could be talking about, your program in general, or sort of the environmental movement at large, is that there is no simple message, or is there? Is there a way to get this message into the hands of people? Like, yes, you've explained it and said, you know, we're not trying to get you out of your car. We're just trying to reduce your costs. It's a win-win-win-win-win. But if that's the case, why isn't everybody doing it? How can you talk about maybe accessing people that aren't prone to look up your sort of thing, or won't hear this interview and immediately go to your website? How do we get those other folks?
Well, that's right, and that's why our PR strategy was not to come on environmental programs. It was to actually try and normalize this behavior and get out to where people talk about this stuff. And, you know, people are watching breakfast television, people are driving in and listening to Metro Morning or whatever it is, and trying to get out there to where, you know, the average person is. And, you know, all of Summer Hill Impact's programs have been around what I call the mom factor. How do you get your mom to participate in something? And my mom's probably listening right now, so she's probably laughing.
Hi, Mom.
But, you know, how do you get the average person to participate? And that's why some of our programs, we partner with the Home Depot on programs. Mm-hmm. We partner with Walmart on programs. We partner with Best Buy on programs. And when we were running Retire Ride, we partner with every gas company and every auto manufacturer there is, because that's where people are making decisions. And if you can get to someone when they're about to make a purchasing decision or about to turn a key somewhere, and if you can get to them at that time, then you're much more likely to create a long-term behavior shift than you are with the nanny state kind of, here's a brochure and thou shalt do this. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to integrate as much as we can environmental thinking into the existing system, economic system that we have, so that you can actually, you know, normalize that kind of behavior. And it works, but, you know, we're definitely not where we need to be.
Have you tried getting on Rob Ford's radio show?
No, I haven't. I should.
Well, I mean,
I
it's just under the simple guise of, you know, we can save Torontonians money. That's, you know, his big thing. So, you know,
he would actually love this program.
I'm not even being sarcastic. I should just be clear, because I've been sarcastic about him the entire rest of the program. So yeah, I'm completely serious. I mean, I think that would be something they could go for.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about, because you mentioned Home Depot there for a second. I've got another sort of angle. It was a problem. Maybe I'm just making this up, but I like to call the Walmart dilemma, mm-hmm. which is, I can never remember the guy's name. As people haven't noticed by now, I'm terrible with names off the top of my head. But there was a famous environmentalist who had done a lot of really good work, and he had years of credit under his belt, and then he got hired by Walmart.
It was Adam Warbeck?
I believe that was it. Thank you. And what people's criticism was, you know, oh, you're going, you know, you've just been bought out and you're going to work for the devil and blah, blah, blah. And his point, which I think is very much a valid one, although a little bit questionable maybe on what that ended up being with that particular case, but his argument, I think, in principle was a valid one, saying, where are you going to have the most impact other than inside Walmart? The whole point that, you know, people don't like them is that they have this massive chokehold on, you know, production and manufacturing. Where else can you make the most difference?
That's right. Not everyone wears hemp jeans and rides their bike to work every day, and you have to take the message to the people. And arguably, Walmart would have the biggest impact if they shifted their processes. They'd have the biggest impact on climate change in the world, because their supply chain is so large. Something like 9% of all you know, goods that come in or imported from China go to Walmart, and so so they have a massive impact. So you could either work against them or you can work with them, and sometimes that works together. You know, it's great to have Greenpeace out in the streets saying, you know, this is the wrong way of doing things, and that kind of supports organizations like ours who are working on the inside to kind of change. So in a sense, it would be great if we worked together. But I believe Walmart is serious about this, and I believe Home Depot is serious about this, and most of the big corporations are serious about it, because it means good business. And that rhetoric of the past of being, you know, jobs versus the environment. I mean, maybe you hear Joe Oliver talking about it, and maybe Rob Ford, but that's a fringe argument right now. And the guys who are serious about driving and strategic about driving business, they are taking this seriously. And so, you know, I see it as one of the key pillars of the people that you have to work with.
So what's we've understood a little bit about what the program's doing now. I understand what your goal is. What are we looking forward for the next year? Are you looking to rapidly roll this out? Are you looking at other cities?
So we're going to roll this out. Nova Scotia is happening next. So we're going to be rolling it out in Nova Scotia in the fall. We're also looking at finding a partner, a private sector partner, like an auto maintenance partner, to come on board to kind of help support the marketing of services that help you drive better. So oil changes, tune-ups, tire rotations, and things like that, and have them come on board. But I also see the data from this being very valuable to the insurance industry. Insurance is slowly shifting to almost a pay-as-you-drive kind of method, and a program like this can actually encourage people to drive better. And that's exactly what insurance companies want. They want to pay less claims. And so between auto companies, gas companies, insurance companies, there's a number of kind of areas where we think there's a benefit. And you know, if just 10% of the people in the GTA participate in this program, we'd see 64,000 tons of GHGs reduced. So there's a massive, massive opportunity here, and it's a practical opportunity. And so we're hoping to expand it as soon as we can.
So what about carryover? I mean, you've got the program, and you have drivers who are doing this, and you said you have sort of like a baseline run, and then your sort of education plus version.
Yeah,
I forget what you called it, but you know, your version with sort of consultation. What about the carryover? Is there any monitoring of people once they leave the program, yeah, and how well they stick to it?
So there's a couple things we're going to do. We're going to survey people throughout every 4 to 6 months to kind of see if they're sticking with it. Some of the meters can stay in the cars, so they can keep them, and there's other kinds of apps that are we're working with a company called Mojo, and they've got other apps that help you identify parking spots, identify different areas kind of tied to your GPS and things like that. So you can keep the app. So from that, we can see. And then the other area is we're partnering with a group out of Waterloo called Cross Chasm, and they've got a great app called My Karma. And based on your individual driving, it will tell you the most fuel-efficient vehicle to buy. So forget about the sticker that's on the car saying that this car uses X number of liters per kilometer. We're actually going to tell you that this is how you drive, and if you purchase the Toyota Prius, this is how much you would save in a year in gas. And so we're going to partner with them and spit out reports so that if people are making that shift to a different car, that make sure that they get into the most fuel-efficient car.
Mm, well, no, I think that's a really important point because one of the biggest – we went to the Canadian International Auto Show this year. We went last year. And I think one of the biggest things where the car companies are all pushing lots and lots of green stuff I won't get back into my rant about which ones were seemed FOS and which ones didn't, but there's a big range. There's a lot of options, but there's a big range, I think, in the honesty and or the seriousness about which the companies are approaching that. So with that in mind, do you think that is one of the big reasons why people aren't buying, say, hybrid vehicles or something like that is because of that they don't know the actual dollars and cents? You know, they hear from one source that it's a waste of money, they hear from another source they could save a lot of money, and they don't know what's what.
And they're confused by all the messages that come from every single car company saying that they're the most fuel efficient, and so no one really knows. But we know that fuel efficiency is still in number one or number two in the reasons why people make a purchase on a vehicle. So that's still very much front of mind for customers. So the more that you can give them information based on their individual lives, and then the better you can shift them to that behavior. And My Karma has noticed that a big increase in the in fuel efficiency of the vehicles that are purchased for people who have got a report, because now it's meaningful to them. If they say, oh yeah, well, seven liters per I don't know what that means. If you get a report that says you're going to save $1,800 a year on gas compared to the car you're using now, well, yeah, okay, that makes sense. So now the price on the car, you can kind of subtract that off the price of the car, and then you're all set. So it's those kinds of practical things that, and I think that once the car companies come on side with that and see an uptick in sales of fuel-efficient vehicles, they'll want to be more transparent on the performance of those vehicles.
Okay. We're going to go to a music break and I think come back and talk about our news item, Kevin, unless you had anything for him before we switch gears here.
Well, it's interesting. So it seems like it's something that could be rolled out quickly and it could have an impact on emissions, and that's always welcome. My only comment would be is that in my opinion, it's impossible to green the car. The personal motor vehicle, we live in an age now where more than 50% of the population lives in urban centers. It's one of the largest sort of noticeable demographic shifts in human history. And so, you know, you have a better than a 50% chance of being an urban dweller now. And I see about as much use for cars in a dense urban setting as I see the need for guns. And I think you can sort of try to, and we have to realize too that, you know, India and China are putting thousands of new cars on the road every day. So the incremental gains you can get by sort of blunting or using fuel more efficiently, say here in Canada, is overwhelmed by production in developing countries that aren't using these technologies. I just think, plus when you factor in the land use issues and the destruction of habitat with the infrastructure it takes to support a car, like the dissecting of habitat into little genetically isolated regions surrounded by highways. I just don't, outside of a city, I can see the need for personal transportation when you live in an area that isn't dense enough to support mass transit. But in any urban setting, I'm just completely, utterly, absolutely opposed to the personal vehicle.
Yeah. No, I'd say that in a sense, whereas if we the three of us could vote on what was the way that the direction that the city should go, I'm sure we would all agree that the public transit. But I think within accepting the the reality of consumer choices that we're not going to be able to flip everybody over to that plan. Not everybody likes our idea right away. So I think a mind for a transition sort of idea with eventually getting eliminating or reducing. And I think it's one of those things where if you start saying, "Oh, I want to eliminate the car," people have this image of like you coming to their house with the police and taking their car keys.
Yeah.
No. We want to convince everybody they don't need it, or convince everybody that there's a better alternative. But I think in the meantime, it's a very good solution. But I would have to agree with Kevin that the end game should be mass public transit and not, you know, slightly greener vehicles.
And I'll add one thing to that, and that end game that is very much in focus for us, because we know that we've been talking to Metrolink since the beginning of this, and they don't have any real data on how people are driving, where they're driving, and when they're driving. So if they're going to actually put in investment into transit, and if they're going to actually try and get people out of cars, and if they're going to actually put in these tools that charge people for congestion fees and things like that, they're going to need some kind of information or data or pilot to kind of, you know, make that case. And so we're hoping that we can kind of provide this. We're working with U of T actually to kind of crunch the numbers at the end of this, to kind of provide to Metrolinx and say, you know, the public isn't that opposed to this stuff. You know, there's all the rhetoric from the politicians, but the public may be okay with getting charged a tax and then reducing their usage of the car. And here is where those pain points may be. So I'm hoping that that data can actually help in a small way lead to that utopia that that you've so well described.
Absolutely. I think that's a perfect note. We'll leave it there for music break. We're going to come right back. We've got, as Corey was insinuating there, we've got a little bit of some comments about Joe Oliver to make today. We'll see if I can, maybe the tech should get ready with the bleep button on this segment. I don't know. We'll see how that goes. But